everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm very pleased to have my old friend Johann Petrovsky-Stern on the show, and we'll be talking about his terrific new book, Jews in the Russian Army, 1827-1917, Drafted into Modernity. You've probably seen Fiddler on the Roof. Almost everyone has seen Fiddler on the Roof, and from that movie, you will have gotten an impression of the treatment of Jews in Imperial Russia. Part of that, this is not dealt with in Fiddler on the Roof, concerns the story of the forcible drafting of young Jewish men, even Jewish boys, by the Imperial Russian Army. This is a sad song and a tale that has been told for many generations now. Now, the thing about Johann's book that is very interesting and challenging is that he calls this entire story into question. The story that he tells is not one of the oppressive Russians wading into the shtetl and forcibly dragging Russian boys to be abused and converted. It's not really that story at all. It's really the story of a modernizing monarch, in this case primarily Nicholas I, not noted as a modernizer, attempting to bring Russian society up to enlightenment speed by including national minorities in the military, the Jews among them. And one of the things that Johann points out is the Jews really weren't treated any differently than other national minorities in the 19th century. It was certainly hard duty, the Russian military, but the Russians themselves, especially the Russian elite, were not so much interested in anti-Semitism as they were in making sure that these Jews and other national minorities served the Tsar as their fellows did. And as Johann points out, the Jews of the shtetl accommodated this new challenge really quite wonderfully. They succeeded in assimilating themselves to the Russian army and more broadly to Russian society. So really, this is a story that is one almost of triumph for them. It's not really a sad story at all. It's a story of normalcy. This is what was happening in the 19th century. So I thought it was a terrific book. And I should also say that Johann's personal story is almost as interesting as the story of Jews in the Russian army in the 19th century. And he talks a little bit about that, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it. I did. And so without further ado, here's the interview. Hi, Johann.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm fine. Just great.
Good. You're
too cold in Chicago, but rather than that, everything is okay.
Too cold. That's the way it comes in the Midwest. Too cold in the winter. That keeps the riffraff out, I think.
Exactly.
I should tell our listeners that we're talking to Johann Petrovsky-Stern today, and we'll be discussing his fantastic new book, Jews in the Russian Army, 1827-1917, the subtitle of which, the very interesting subtitle, is Drafted into Modernity. I've read the book. It's terrific. I've worked with Johann for many years, and it's a real treat for me to be able to talk to him again, because he's certainly one of the most interesting fellows I have ever met. You don't have to respond to that, Johann. That's okay. I know you're modest. But why don't we...
Thank you, Marshall.
Why don't you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself, where you come from, how you became interested in history, and so on and so forth.
Marshall, thank you very much for having me on your show. Sure. First, I need to tell you that in order for me to tell the story where I was born and how I managed to get where I am now, we need approximately a semester, maybe a quarter and a half.
I believe that's true. I've heard your story, and I'm telling you, I think you're right. But see if we can condense it, the Reader's Digest version.
Right, Reader's Digest version. So, in brief, I was born about 45 years ago, somewhere in the middle of nowhere called Kiev, Ukraine, which was the then Soviet Union. And I was raised by an assimilated, relatively Jewish family, nominally Jewish family. I knew nothing about Jewish studies. The beginning and the end of my knowledge of Judaica was the word tumbalalaika. And this word I heard not from Jewish songs, but from the song by a famous Russian dissident bard, Alexander Galich. Mm-hmm. Which means that I was a normal Soviet kid, interested in all sorts of cultural pursuits, and among these pursuits, one of the most important things for me was comparative literature. Mm-hmm. My father was a scholar, and still is a scholar, of Russian and Soviet literature, and I thought that I'll do something that he does not do. I got interested in Latin American and European literature of the 19th, 20th century, And after graduating from Kiev University with approximately five languages, I became a grad student at Moscow University, where I presented my dissertation in 1988, and it was on the politics of Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
I'm laughing because it's pretty far from what you do now, but go ahead.
Right. Well, if you think that Pueblo, Latin American, Colombian Pueblo, is something like a shtetl,
okay,
but on the other side of the ocean, you will get approximately to where I am now.
All right.
But this is to be postponed for the next part of our conversation.
Okay.
Now, after that, I taught about 5 years in Kiev as a professor in Kiev University, the Department of Comparative Literature. I taught the survey of European novel. I taught the history of aesthetics, the theory of the novel, certainly Romanticism, Renaissance, 20th century modernism, and so on and so forth. At the same time, I became very much interested in a number of writers who, so to say, shaped my interest in the history of religion. First and foremost, Jorge Luis Borges.
Mm-hmm.
And I prepared and edited and published in 1992 the edition of Borges in Russian, which covered pretty much everything Borges wrote on history of different religions.
Mm-hmm.
While commenting upon Borges, I realized that I'm very comfortable with his quotes from Thomas Kempis or St. Thomas Aquinas, but I'm not uncomfortable with a bunch of names that he was using, and I really didn't know where they were coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly these were all Hebrew terms, Kabbalistic terms, names of Spanish Jewish writers, philosophers, and so on and so forth. And I thought that it's a shame that I'm considering myself, you know, so prominently positioned among East European intellectuals, and I know nothing about, you know, these clumsy guys, and I decided to know something, to learn something about them.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, you know, Borges drew me to my quest for Judaism, and
mm-hmm.
This is the time when I really shifted from Latin American European modernism to the study of Jewish history.
Yeah, through Borges. You have to say,
right.
That's pretty curious. That's very interesting. So then at that point, that was about what year, and what did you decide to do?
I would not tell you what year, because it was actually not just 1 year, but one day.
Really?
Right. It was one day when I was standing near the so-called White House, Yeltsin's residence, during the famous or infamous coup of the Tutsis against Yeltsin, and I was standing there, so to say, among the defenders of the White House, a couple of nights, and I had plenty of time to think about who I am, where I'm going. You know, people were waiting to be smashed by the tanks approaching Moscow, and I used this time to think about myself. So, but by that time, I already submitted my edition of Borges, of Ortega y Gasset, of G.K. Chesterton, of Leonardo Sciascia. So I had four books forthcoming, you know,
mm-hmm.
with my with different level of my participation. And at that point, I decided that I'm going nowhere. Really, I'm spreading myself too thin. And at that very moment, I decided, well, it's time for me to look for the depth.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I decided to go for Judaic studies.
Did you also have a simultaneous religious conversion? Did you go to the shul and say, teach me, or?
It's difficult to say. Eventually, I did. But I started with, you know, I was approximately, let's say, 30 years old, and I started with studying the difference between Aleph and Beit, because uh-huh. I literally did not know alphabet.
Yeah.
So it was just starting really from scratch. People who have some sort of Jewish education in this country do not understand the level of zero I had at that particular time. I started really from ground zero.
Yeah, you're very modest. Go ahead.
Right. So thought I managed to master the basics of Hebrew language, and
mm-hmm.
I went to Jerusalem. I spent some time in the yeshiva. My wife quite nicely sponsored my trip to Jerusalem. And it was all independently done. I was not sponsored by any kind of fancy schmancy Jewish organizations. I was not affiliated with anybody. But when I came back, I was invited by a local library where they had declassified a huge collection of Judaica manuscripts, uh-huh. and they asked me to work with this collection. This is how I became interested in Jewish books, Jewish manuscripts, and through these manuscripts and books, I came to conversion and I came to the discovery of the importance of Jewish history.
So the conversion and the conversion to Judaic studies happened simultaneously, but not exactly, you know, on the same time scale. Is that right?
Right. I would say first I went for some knowledge. Mm-hmm. And while I realized I am already reading Hebrew manuscripts, I realized I cannot go anywhere until I know something about Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And this purely intellectual curiosity brought me to this horrible Chicago ghetto where I'm now sitting
right.
with my black yarmulke.
Exactly.
I was going to say that you were kind of a Shiva bucher without the Shiva part, and then you got the Shiva part later. Yeah.
Well, I would say the following in regard to my Yeshiva education. When I got my Rothschild Fellowship in 94-95, and I spent a year with my family in Jerusalem, I came back to the yeshiva where I had been in 93 and asked them to provide me with a rabbi who would just sit with me and, yeah. and study with me what they call Blood Gemara, mm-hmm. the Talmud.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a very intensive, I would say, 10-month-long education. And after that, so mm-hmm. since 96, I'm trying to be what they call in the yeshivish world a matmid. Matmid is a person who learns the Talmud on the daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
Another, so the Talmud is in the center of my interest. I do the legal codes such as Shulchan Aruch and other things, but, mm-hmm. but I was trying to have what they call chevruta, that is to say, the daily study with mm-hmm. vis-a-vis somebody. So you study with somebody, and this somebody, in my case, is a rabbi from the Telz Yeshiva.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm doing this for already 10 years. I came to the United States as a graduate student who wanted to get a new kind of education at Brandeis University. So in 96, I came to this country to study under Antony Polanski
mm-hmm.
And to do my research and write my dissertation on East European Jewish history.
Mm-hmm.
And this is was already the time when I thought I have my dissertation in the pocket. I wanted to do the self-governing organizations in the Pale of Settlement, late 18th, early 19th century, and I wanted to show I wanted to discuss the fragmentation of the power in a Jewish community at that particular time, before and after Nicholas I took the power.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a project, and I didn't know that I will be competitive enough to be able to fight for a place for myself at an American university after I finish my studies. But this is exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, that's great. And that's where we met, actually, in Boston, if I recall, many, many years ago. Is that right?
Yes. I owe you my first scholarly publication.
Wasn't your first scholarly publication. It was your 40th or something.
No. Look, I do not count my publication British, French, Italian, Spanish, and Latin American literature.
That's that modesty thing again. You have to stop that.
Right. you know, there is this Spanish proverb that I like and that does not exist in English. It is borrón y cuenta nueva. It means that you blot out, you cross out an entire paragraph, and you start from the new line, writing your life from the beginning.
Yeah.
You know what Pasternak used to call места и главы жизни целой, отчеркивая на полях.
Uh-huh.
So you cross out the places and the chapters of your life, and you start anew. This is why I'm saying
you are
to blame when we talk about the beginning of my academic career at the United States.
Okay, well, it was a pleasure working with you then, and it is now. So let's. So you started by working on, was that the Kahal? Hall that you were talking about? You were working on the
Yourself.
Yeah. And so how did you get to the Russian army, or to the Jews in the Russian army?
That's an interesting question. And this is what happened. I was studying what they call Chavurot. Chavurot are local, self-governing, voluntary, philanthropic learning societies, ubiquitous in each and every shtetl in the Pale of Settlement. And by the shtetl, I mean a private Polish town, eventually submitted under Russian control, that had, I would say, some percentage of Poles, some percentage of Russian Orthodox, but mostly Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
So I was studying this particular environment, and I was very much interested in what they call Pinkasim, the records of this Jewish societies that give you a glimpse into what the society was about, into their statutes, into their regulations, into their philanthropic activities, into their learning pursuits, into the into their encounter with Hasidism, and by Hasidism I mean the movement of religious revivalism, mm-hmm. very popular in East Europe at the end of the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I came to Leningrad or St. Petersburg at that time. I don't remember. It was 94. Right. In Russia, things change so fast, you know. You have to have somebody who will be in control just of the name change and just the great dissertation in Russian history.
The Bureau of Name Changes. Yes.
Right, exactly. So I am there for a conference sponsored by American Jewish Committee, and I got a call from the Museum of Ethnography, Russian Museum of Ethnography.
Mm-hmm.
And the lady who is in charge of the famous East European Judaica collection at this Museum of Ethnography asked me whether I can come and look at a manuscript that they cannot identify.
Hmm.
I asked her who had seen the manuscript, and she told me, she named a number of Israeli scholars, very prominent scholars, who looked at the manuscript, could understand what it is about, but really could not identify it. They could not read the title, and the title was in Hebrew. So, you know, I was amazed that, you know, people look at the Hebrew title and cannot understand what it is about. I asked her, what is it about? She says, this is kind of a record book of an ethnic group. Well, I've never seen record books of ethnic groups because, you know, if you're Jewish, you're Jewish. You cannot be, you know, Chuvash Jew or Tatar Jew.
Yeah.
That's it. You're done. You're stuck. So I went there. She put a manuscript in front of me. It was a very nicely preserved manuscript in folio. And on the title page, there were two words, or maybe three words. It said, Chevra or Chavura, Shel Bryansky Polk.
Yeah.
That is to say, a Jewish society of the Bryansk Regiment.
Yeah.
And certainly it was a transliterated Russian title.
Yeah.
The first word was in Hebrew, and the two other were in Russian, transliterated in Hebrew.
Yeah.
Oh, and I was absolutely amazed because this was a society of observant Jews who were drafted into the Russian army about 1843, and they managed to create a society that lasted until 1893.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 50 years of longevity, which was an amazing thing to begin with. I knew about similar things. I've heard about them, but I've never seen actually a manuscript. And this manuscript reflected the movements of the regiment, the participation of the regiment in the Hungarian, Austro-Hungarian campaign 48, in Polish campaign 1830s, in another Polish campaign 1863-1864, in the Crimean War 1854-55. So these guys were in all sorts of wars, and
mm-hmm.
they managed to remain observant guy, or relatively observant. I don't know, you know, it's a prescriptive document. It's not a descriptive document. But if, you know, they are commissioning the Torah scroll for themselves, it means that they are continuing to act as mm-hmm. as a prayer group, as a learning group, as a group that you know, brings different Jews together from different companies of the regiment, and they do something together.
Mm-hmm.
So this manuscript really was a gear that really turned me into a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really within my intellectual interests. So this is exactly what I was looking for. I was looking for this kind of voluntary societies and self-governing organizations. But then I asked myself a question, maybe I should use it and write something about Jews in the Russian army.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a chapter in the book that you and Eric
mm-hmm.
Lorre very nicely published with
mm-hmm.
Brill.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a number of other chapters. And then I saw that, well, I'm at Brandeis. People who teach me really ask very important questions about modernization, assimilation,
mm-hmm.
integration, acculturation, imperialization of the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm stuck with my ghettoized topic, you know, about the self-governing societies,
mm-hmm.
the shtetl. Maybe I should do something different, maybe
mm-hmm.
it's more challenging, maybe more complex,
mm-hmm.
maybe something that I would not do as fast as I, you know, could have done this other dissertation for which I had already all my primary sources handy. And I decided to write a dissertation about Jews in the Russian army.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this is how I got to the book and to mm-hmm. the archives of the Russian military in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how we got to the book, Jews in the Russian Army,
Drafted
in Modernity.
Mm-hmm,
right.
I see. Well, you know, it's a terrific topic. And one of the things I really liked about the book was its very direct and straightforward confrontation of what we might call Jewish, and especially Eastern European Jewish, folklore about the relationship between Jews and the Russian army. And by folklore, what I mean is the stories that everyone seems to know, all Jews know about the way that Jews were dragooned into the Russian army and how this was horribly oppressive. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that background.
Right. Thank you for this opportunity. When I came to this country, the first Shabbat, I'm sitting next to a Rebbetzin and to a rabbi, and Rebbetzin asks me about my field of interest, and I mentioned something about my subfield of interest, and she says, well, I'll tell you a story. And she tells me a story how her grandfather in 1897 ran away from the Russian army, or ran away from the draft, because he did not want to serve for 25 years in the Russian army. And yeah, you laugh because you know that 25 service was something that did not exist already after 1834.
Yeah.
Now, what kind of 1897 you are talking about?
Yeah.
Which means that people still live with this myth that Russian army is about drafting the minors, and nobody but Jews are drafted as minors. Then they keep them busy for 25 years, and they convert them under duress into Russian Orthodoxy. And if you do not convert, they torture you. And these stories continue until 1917, until the triumphant Soviet power comes and redeems the Jews from the oppression. Well,
mm-hmm.
you know, I've heard the stories, and unfortunately, these stories shaped mostly, I would say, 100% of literature, of literary criticism, and most scholars drew heavily from these literary sources, I would say, you know, quite prominently a number of years ago, 2 years ago, somebody in Israel published a book about the Tsar's children soldiers. And it's about this Jewish children who were drafted as teenage kids to the army, and about their horrible fate there. And it's all based on literary sources. So people do not look at what really was going on in the army. And I asked myself a question, to what extent the story we are telling is really a history.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that it is not history. It's something different. And I understood that in order to really find out what is going on, we have to do a different kind of a search. And it's important to look not only at these poor kids who I really sympathize with very much through the prism of the Jewish community, but rather we have to look at them through the prism of the Russian military.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to understand what was really the fate of the Jews in the Russian army, I have to ask the Russian army, what did you do to the Jews who were drafted?
Mm-hmm.
And I spent about 2 years in a different Russian military archives. Probably you know that Русский военно-исторический архив, Российский военно-исторический архив, Russian historical military archive is the biggest and the richest archive in the Russian Federation. It has 7 million files, enormous amount of documents. And the period that I was looking at from 1827 till 1917 was pretty well covered. The only thing was to find out the material related to Jews in the archives. And so then I realized that the military was trying to religiously accommodate this Jews settlers in the Russian army. Different important laws and regulations were issued in order to, I would say, guarantee their freedom of conscience.
Let's just take before we go there, let's take one step back before you talk about their attempts to accommodate in whatever way they did Jewish religious practice. And because one of the things I really liked about the book was the very beginning where you point out, and I want you to talk a little bit about this, that the Russians and Nicholas I actually comes off in your book as quite an enlightened fellow. He's not usually the way we think about him, but the attempt to bring Jews into the army and to modernize them in this way was not particularly Russian. It was part of a more general tendency among large monarchical states after the French Revolution and even before to create what we would now call kind of civil rights and obligations, that the Russians were hardly the first and the Jews were not picked out among nationalities. And in fact, this was an attempt to make everyone equal. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Right. Look, I believe you are absolutely right. I spent about 100 pages at the beginning of the book discussing the European context. And this is what I think is my modest contribution to the field. Whatever I discuss, I am trying to apply the method that I call, you know, it's not a historical term, I just call it this way. I call it an accurate context. By the accurate context, I mean the immediate context. If you look at Nicholas I through the prism of the great reforms of the 1860s, 1870s in Russia, you would say certainly Alexander II is a great reformer, is an enlightened monarch, and so on and so forth, and Nicholas I is a schmuck. However, if you look at Nicholas, placing him in his immediate environment, you will see that he is the most enlightened among his crazy colleagues. There are approximately 2.5 people who can rely, who he can rely on, Uvarov and Kisilov, but much later in his career. And when he starts in 25, there are really nobody who would support his enlightened approach to the imperial development. And what he does, he simply continues the politics towards national minorities in borderlands that you would find in France, in Prussia, in Italy, and in Austria. So he is really following the steps of the enlightened monarchs, and he is an enlightened monarch. This is one of the interesting things that I discovered about him. He certainly is not interested in just bringing Jews into the army and Christianize them. Well, he thinks about that. I don't want to say that he does not entertain this kind of an idea. He does, but this is not his primary purpose. He wants to extend rights and duties to the borderlands, and he wants to integrate the borderlands into the main society. Remember, all this territory where Jews live are new to Russia. Russia did not have any Jews before 1772. Russia partitioned Poland between 1772 and 1795, and now, together with this chunk of Polish territory, Russia also inherited between 900,000 and 1,200,000 Jews. Right? And they are absolutely not integrated into society. Catherine makes the first step trying to integrate them into different Russian estates, town dwellers and merchants. And then Nicholas makes the next step. He says, well, let's make them useful to the society, for the society. So for him, it's very important to have Jews who are fulfilling the duties. This is something that people did not realize when they were looking at Nicholas. They were saying, well, Nicholas is really extending the duties and not extending the rights. That's correct. I do not doubt that that's correct. Mm-hmm. But the problem of Nicholas is that he does this for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For him, the duty is more important than the rights. Because the rights he associates with the Decembrist movement, mm-hmm. and with the French Revolution, and he knows you extend the rights, you end up being decapitated as the French monarchs. He does not want this fate.
Mm-hmm.
But for him to make duties equally distributed among different strata of the population, among different ethnic groups in Russia, this is what is important. And this is certainly a modernizing step.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely, absolutely. It's interesting in that way, because he does follow on, I think he was probably looking across the border at Austria and saying, so that they've done this, and so we can probably do it as well. In fact, we have some of their old territory, so we can probably get away with it. I'm interested in the question, though, of how the communal organizations that you know so much about reacted to the announcement and then imposition of the draft. What did the Kahal and these other organizations say about it?
Look, I'll tell you something about that, but I need to mention that the first person to describe this communal reaction was the Columbia professor Michael Stanislavski, and what he did without access to the archives,
mm-hmm.
yet he was able to say a number of important things that I just capitalize on.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have another person who was working on this on a similar subject, mm-hmm. Olga Lipa, who published a book about the literary response to conscription, and she also discusses the communal reaction to.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not I'm not here the person who really discovers the things, but I'll tell you just very briefly mm-hmm. what he was trying to do. First, how did I manage to reconstruct what I'm going to tell you? The late John Clear from University College London
mm-hmm.
Told me on a number of occasions that unfortunately the archive of the Jewish Committee in St. Petersburg was burnt in 1862-63, and we know about this fire in the Ministry of the Interior in Russia that destroyed this archive. So the proceedings of the committee, which really discussed the draft and the reaction to the draft, were lost.
Mm-hmm.
I was sitting in Warsaw working on my Stettel book, doing absolutely different things, and looking at small Stettlach in Poland and in Russia. And suddenly I came across a copy of these proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
How could they end up in Warsaw? I believe Nicholas exchanged his views and his plans with Konstantin.
Mm-hmm.
His brother, and he used to send him copies of most important documents that contained Nicholas' plans of how to reorganize this part of the society or this ethnic group and so on. And Konstantin simply had these files in front of him. So this is how they ended up in Warsaw. So sitting in Warsaw, I managed to reconstruct what nobody had been able to reconstruct working in Moscow and St. Petersburg and other places.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So now, what I realize is that when the communities understood that the government is trying to introduce new kind of regulations and extend the draft to the Jews, they first tried to bribe the officials.
Mm-hmm.
They raised funds, enormous funds,
mm-hmm.
in hundreds of thousands of silver rubles.
Mm-hmm.
Every Jewish family would contribute a grosh, a kopeck,
mm-hmm.
but something they contributed because they did not want this to take place. At the next stage, when they realized this does not work, they rushed to the Hasidic masters. They asked the Hasidic masters to intervene. Why the Hasidic masters? Because, they knew that's a Kabbalistic and Talmudic concept that became very popular among Jews in the 19th century. Hashem gozer gzera ve'atzadik mevatla, literally, God creates, in brackets, an evil decree against his, chosen people, the
mm-hmm.
Jews. And the Hasidic master, the tzaddik, the head of the Hasidic court, is able to cancel it.
Mm-hmm.
So this Talmudic quote became enveloped in some sort of an aura, and this aura was connected to a Hasidic master. People thought that, you know, Hasidic masters really can't cancel the evil decrees of the government.
Mm-hmm.
Also didn't work. So the next step was to simply do whatever they could to avoid the draft, and it did not help. Now, what is interesting, and I believe this is quite a novelty, when people discuss the draft of Jews, they talk about hundreds and thousands of people who were drafted. But when I looked at the figures, I was amazed. Look, we are talking about, let's say, 1.5 million Jews in the Pale of Settlement in 1827. You know how many Jews were drafted?
Hmm.
How many Jews were in the books of the ministry of in the war ministry?
Hmm. Go ahead, tell us.
How many?
I don't know. So
1800.
1800, yeah.
1800, right? So, and it was up to the community to decide who will be drafted. And
mm-hmm.
the community realized that in order not to send to the army people who are paying taxes and who are really earning, you know, some small buck, they'd rather have minors drafted.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a decision of the Kahal. It was not the decision of the Russian government. It was a decision of the Kahal, of the umbrella organization mm-hmm. of the Jewish community in every shtetl, that they would draft this amount of minors and this amount of adults. And this is how we ended up having 800 children and 800 adult Jews sent to the Russian army in 1827.
Mm-hmm. Were there people at this time, this very early moment in the imposition of conscription, who stood up and said, you know, this is our obligation as imperial subjects, and if we want to be treated equally, then we have to send our sons to the army?
Very, very, very few. There were so-called maskilim, enlightened Jews,
mm-hmm.
But even these maskilim were saying, yes, to serve in the army is a good thing, but to serve in the Russian army under the present conditions is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by present condition? Look, in Austria, in Prussia, in Italy, or in France, let's say we are the family and our children are dropped into the army.
Mm-hmm.
We want to visit them. We can go and visit them. It's not a big deal, right? But in Russia, with the Pale of Settlement and with the prohibition of for Jews to live or reside or go outside the Pale of Settlement,
mm-hmm.
and the Pale of Settlement is 15 western provinces of the empire,
mm-hmm.
it actually implied that if you were relative or your child is drafted into the army and sent in, let's say, in Yelutarovsk, in Tobolsk, in Kazan, or in Simbirsk, or, you know, in St. Petersburg, you cannot go and visit him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you're losing this contact with your relative. And
mm-hmm.
it was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe you're right.
Yeah, no, I see what you mean.
What they did not realize, they thought that, you know, it's like sending your child into the territory of the enemy, into
mm-hmm.
the territory which is religiously alien to you.
Mm-hmm.
They did not realize that under the pressure, the war ministry would introduce laws that would allow, that would accommodate observant Jews, and 100% of them were observant in the army as Jews.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've anticipated my next question, as I expected you would. What attempts did the Russian government under Nicholas make to accommodate Jewish religious practices and travel and things like this?
Again, I believe it's important to look at what they did for not only for Jews, but
mm-hmm.
only for other ethnic and religious minorities.
Mm-hmm.
Muslims were allowed to have their imams in the army, and the imams were allowed to have beards, something,
mm-hmm.
you know, not usually accepted in certain regiments.
Mm-hmm.
The same can be said about Jews. Jews were allowed to have their prayer groups. The army would appoint a person in the regiment who would be responsible for keeping the religious artifacts such as prayer shawls and phylacteries were given to the soldiers whenever they needed them. I don't think they put phylacteries every morning. I don't think it's feasible, but they did have the holidays. They were able to to observe certain holidays and Shabbat. The list of the holidays and semi-holidays were distributed among the regimental commanders. And from what I know is that more often than not, the regimental commanders were sympathetic to having Jews observing their holidays. Why? Because they knew if they do not celebrate, if they do not spend time, you know, as a religious community, they would go drink and play cards and go to the brothel. That's what Russian soldiers do, right? So yeah. it was not because they were so philo-Semitic. I don't want to say that, and I'm not saying that. They simply, you know, what the army commander is interested in the discipline, right? Yeah. And they know that you let these Jews pray for 4 hours in their prayer room, and that they were allocating prayer rooms in different barracks and in different facilities rented by the army from the local dwellers, and they would allocate a room for the Jewish soldiers, and Jewish soldiers would go there to to get together for the celebration of a holiday or of Shabbat.
Mm-hmm. What did they do about keeping kosher?
I think this is out of question. I think they all became, so to say, modern American Jews, mm-hmm. people who know something about Judaism, people who celebrate certain holidays, but people who do not eat kosher food.
Right.
I think that having kosher food was absolutely out of question for most Jews who were in the Russian army.
Uh-huh.
There were attempts at a later stage in the 1860s, 1870s of different communities, especially in Poland, to provide the reserve soldiers who were now brought to the army for, I would say, 2-3 months training.
Mm-hmm.
There were attempts of the local communities to provide them with the kosher food, but this kosher food was so meager and so bad that in most cases the soldiers, the commanders would say, you should eat from the regimental pot.
Mm-hmm. What did the Rebbe say about this? Did they give them, because there are allowances that can be given for this kind of thing, did they say to the observant Jews, well, it's okay if you don't keep kosher while you're in the army?
No, the rabbis did not say that.
Mm-hmm.
Most rabbis let me emphasize this. Most rabbis in East Europe would not endorse eating non-kosher food.
Really?
Most rabbis in Austria, in Prussia, in France, and in Italy would say serving in the army means that you are fulfilling a religious obligation
vis-à-vis
the state, right? And there is a law: when you fulfill one religious obligation, you are exempt from other obligations.
Right. Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
People would say, you do that, but don't worry about the kosher food.
Yeah.
Most rabbis in East Europe, including such an illustrious rabbi as the Chafetz Chaim, whose real name is Israel Meir HaKohen Pupko, who lived in Rabin and was the top-notch authority among the rabbinic scholars at the end of the 19th, early 20th century, he wrote a book, a religious digest, I would say, for the observant soldiers. It's like a 150-page book that delineates all sorts of obligations of the observant Jews in the Russian army. And he would say, you should abstain from meat. You should certainly eat only vegetarian food. Those are the ways for you to stay kosher over Passover when the laws become extremely cumbersome. So he really delineated all these ways to circumvent the necessity to eat non-kosher food, and he would say, you should still keep kosher. My understanding is that it did not work. These are all prescriptive documents, and when I look into what was going on in the regiments, I understand the soldiers had a wonderful dilemma, either to start from death or to eat non-kosher food.
Yeah.
And when you're a soldier, when you have to carry weaponry, when you have to do all sorts of physical work, you know what will be your choice.
Yeah, no, I know exactly. So
what were relations like between let's just say, to pick one, the major ethnic group, Russian soldiers and Jewish soldiers?
My sense is that relations might be tense, and were quite tense, between the soldiers and the officers, the NCOs and the colonels. But on the level of the army, on the among the rank and file, the relations were quite normal, sympathetic, and very rarely intense. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen a single fact, a single occurrence that I would put on the table and say, oh, this is the manifestation of the animosity between the Russian soldiers and the Jewish soldiers. Once you are a soldier, you are a soldier. Mm-hmm. Who you are religiously and so on and so forth, this is very, very secondary. Moreover, quite often I saw that Russian soldiers of Russian Orthodox descent and Jewish soldiers and Georgian soldiers and Tatar soldiers are getting together for a drink, are allowing one another, if one of them is under arrest, mm-hmm. to run away, or doing all sorts of things that show that on the horizontal level there were much more sympathetic relations than on the vertical level, and this conflicts on the vertical level certainly were, I would say, class conflicts rather than religious conflicts.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because you know, I suppose this is a bad analogy, but I'll make it anyway because it occurs to me. You know, Americans will often tell the story of the integration of blacks into the American Army in the Truman administration, and then point to the fact that it was a marvelous engine of broader social integration. Would you say the same thing is true of the Russian case in the 19th century between Russians and Jews?
Yes and no. I've seen, by the way, a number of American movies about Afro-American soldiers and their plight in the army, mm-hmm. Which was sometimes as difficult as the plight of the Jews mm-hmm. in the Russian army. However, an Afro-American soldier in the American army would obtain all sorts of privileges mm-hmm. and rights once he is out of the army, once he retires.
Mm-hmm.
This was not the case in the Russian army.
Mm-hmm.
So again, duties were extended to the Jews, but not necessarily rights. It's interesting that those who served under strictest laws of the army of Nicholas I between, I would say, 1827 and the 1860s, before the after Nicholas, but before the military reform of 1874,
mm-hmm.
These Jews were allowed to remain in their place of service, or even to resettle outside of the Pale of Settlement.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the most important privileges for a Jew in Russia to be able to reside outside of the Pale of Settlement was open for the Jewish soldiers who served under the Nikolaevan army.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I've read another book recently about a similar sort of topic. I actually interviewed the author, and it's about the indigene, that is the French colonial troops that were brought to France during World War I, and they were sent back home, and they felt very hard done about this, that they weren't given, because the French promised them all kinds of rights of citizenship and then gave them. Was there anyone in the Jewish community who said, you know, well, we served our time in the army, and now we should be released from the bondage which has been imposed upon us?
This issue became a big political issue when the war ministry commissioned a number of people to think what to do with the Jews in the reformed army after 1874.
Mm-hmm.
And this issue became a hot political issue discussed by each and every Russian Jewish journalist,
mm-hmm.
In Russian Jewish press, in Hebrew Russian press, in Yiddish Russian press, in the 1870s and up to the 1910s. Everybody was saying, we are fulfilling our sacred obligation vis-a-vis the state. We deserve the right to be considered full-fledged citizens, or they did not use the word citizen at the time, they used the word full-fledged subject.
Yes.
Of a state. We need to be given a chance to reside outside the Pale of Settlement. The Pale of Settlement should be lifted, and Jews should be allowed to live everywhere in the country, and this would certainly alleviate the economic burden of the crowded Jewish communities in the Shtetl, Spektia, and the Pale.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Is this the origin of the Russian Jewish question?
Well, one of the things, the reason I ask this is that, you know, I study the 16th and 17th century, and you're quite right to say that Jews to Russians before the mid, let's say, 18th century existed only as an idea. They had never met any of them because there were none of them in Russia. So there really couldn't be a Jewish question, although they did write about Jews. They only did it from what they knew from the Old Testament. But then in the 19th century, you know, they have this profound confrontation with these Jews. And at that point, it enters publicistic discussion. And at some point it becomes, you start to see what is a modern kind of anti-Semitism. That's what I was hoping you would talk about.
Let me step back for a second. When you say the origins of the Jewish question, I need to emphasize that Jews were not a question to anybody in Russia among Russian governmental hierarchs between, I would say, the 1800s and the 1860s, 1870s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to overemphasize the importance of the Jewish question in the times of Nicholas I. Mm-hmm. Or Alexander I. The Jewish question becomes an important issue in the 1860s mm-hmm. and onward. However, this is an interesting story. The first, I think, the first most important story written by a Russian Jewish writer on the Jewish question in Russia was about the reaction of the Jewish communities to the draft of the mm-hmm. Jews and about the draft of the Jews to the Russian army.
Mm-hmm.
So starting, and this story appeared, I believe, I might be a mistake, 1859. It was written by Osip Rabinovich, and the story was called Strafnoy, the penalty soldier,
yeah.
about one of the Kahal elders drafted into the army, and mm-hmm. he's an enlightened Jew, so he's reading Moses Mendelssohn while he is in the army, mm-hmm. and he's an elderly person who has to serve under the strict laws of the Nikolaevan army. So it's quite a passionate story written by a person who understands that, look, you draft us into the army and you do not extend rights to us. Starting from this particular time, until I would say the times of Vasily Grossman, to the times of when Vasily Grossman writes his novel Life and Fate.
Life and Fate, yeah.
The question of Jews serving in the Russian army is perhaps the most important question for the forging of the Russian Jewish identity and for the discussion of the Russian treatment of the Jews.
Uh-huh.
So we have a record of Russian Jewish writers who all the time address one the same topic. So when they need to discuss the hottest issue related to the Jewish question in Russia, they turn to the role of the Jewish in the Russian army or to the Jewish soldiers or to the communal response to the conscription.
Uh-huh. And why is it so important? Why do they always come back to this topic?
Because I think they feel that whatever Jews do, however heroic are their deeds on the front, they come back to their place of residence and mm-hmm. be on the street as Jews.
Yeah, and this is
before 1917 and after 1917. And
yeah.
you feel this in the Red Cavalry by Babel. You feel it
yeah.
In books by Rabinovich. You feel it in many writings of Yiddish and Hebrew writers who are in Russia, and certainly in the novel by Grossman.
Yeah, no, I notice what you mean. I mean, is that kind of notion that they won't properly assimilate, at least in the way that the Russians want them to assimilate. I was going to ask a kind of ridiculous question, if you don't mind. We're coming to the end of the interview, but I watch a lot of war movies. I just like them. And I don't like war, but I like war movies. And maybe you have as well. In many American war movies, especially in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, there's always a character of the plucky Jewish guy from Brooklyn, the fast-talking Jewish guy. He's one of the guys. You know, there's the farm boy, and there's the rich kid, and there's the NCO with the cigar in his mouth, and then there's the West Point grad, and there's the plucky Jewish guy from Brooklyn who has a heavy Brooklyn accent. Is there any similar sort of character in Russian or in Yiddish letters of the Jewish soldier?
I would say in the writings of Russian Jewish writers, there are plenty of these kind of images. Think about the image of Levinson in Fadeev's novel Razgrom.
Mm-hmm.
The Defeat, one of the most important novels about the conquest of Far East by the Red Army troops mm-hmm. During the Civil War in Russia.
Yeah, I've not read it, unfortunately.
And there is an image of a Jewish, not only soldier, he is one of the leaders of the detachment, and he's bad.
Mm-hmm.
He's very ambiguously portrayed, but he is certainly... not very well integrated into Russian media, and he is feeble and he is indecisive. So there are many bad things that you can say about him.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the case of the movies. You do not see Jewish soldiers in the Russian movies, unlike you have, for instance, an image of a Jewish soldier in Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, exactly. That's what I was thinking, and I was trying to think of Russian war movies I've seen, Белое солнце в пустыне. I can't think of a Jewish soldier in that one, and that's sort of your classic sort of Russian epic war film. But I don't think Ivanovo Detstvo. There's no. I can't think of anything in one of those. But so it's interesting that that doesn't exist. Let me ask this question: did you discover in the course of your research, or was this sort of family lore that your grandfather, who had volunteered for the Russian army?
Oh, I knew that. I knew that. Look, I knew this since time immemorial. This was not a big deal for me. It was just in the family archive, this photo that I published in the book. Semyon Vasilyevich Petrovsky, who volunteered in the Russian army, and he was certainly born Shimon the Mayor Stern. And he was a volunteer in the Russian army from 1914 or 1915 until the end of the First World War, and then he served in the Russian army, in this Red Army,
mm-hmm.
After 1917, and then he was again a Jewish soldier in the Russian army after 1941. Mm-hmm. He also volunteered. So it was something normal, but I never wanted to do what people think I was trying to do. I was never trying to reconstruct the context
mm-hmm.
Of his service. I was not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, my dissertation ended up in 1914 exactly because I did not want to
mm-hmm.
take a look at the First World War. I added a chapter, I think it's not a bad chapter, I added it to a book, so you will find a chapter covering the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it was done not to accommodate my memories about my grandfather, who I remember pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are, let me ask this question, you are calling into question what is kind of sacred Jewish lore about the 19th century Jewish past. Many people still tell these stories, as you know, and remember how the evil Tsarist authorities came. You know, I'm thinking, actually, you just brought to mind, what is the name of the movie Fiddler on the Roof?
Right.
Yeah, you see these things. Now, you're calling into question some of this. How has the book been received among sort of broader circles? Or do we know yet?
Look, certainly it raises some brows, no doubt about it. People would like to hear the story how we suffered, how we ran away from the old world, and how we are happy here in America.
Yeah.
And I'm telling the story about Russian government being quite often rational and rationalistic, about Russian army treating Jews evenly, about Jews who managed. You know, we managed. That's what I'm telling. I'm telling a different kind of a story. I'm telling a story about normalcy. And they want to tell to hear the story about suffering. So this normalcy is something that people have to... I'm looking for a word. They have to live with it.
Yeah, they have to accept it. Yeah, understand.
And they have to have guts to be able to accept the story.
And I
believe this story is much more important than telling a story about the incessant Jewish sufferings under the Russian regime. I think I'm telling a very different story.
Yeah.
I'm telling a story about normalcy and about rationalism, about modernization. And I'm showing that these Jews managed. You know, so I'm looking at the grades of the cantonist battalions, and I'm showing that Jews are, in the mainstream.
Yeah, yeah.
Which means that they managed.
Yeah, I think it's a very important story, and I'm glad. You know, it's funny. I really like the way you put that. How, you know, the Americans love to tell this story about how they suffered in the old world, and then they broke loose of their bonds and came to the new world, and they're happy. Basically, every American ethnic group tells that story. It's just the classic American story. My people tell that story, and we escaped from Germany. You know, it's like Germany was bad in the early 19th century, and so we came here, and then we were happy.
Right.
Look, I don't know how bad Germany was really, but I know my relatives said it was really bad.
I'm trying to say something very different. I'm saying that there are different yardsticks to measure normalcy.
Yeah.
And if we measure Russian normalcy with its Russian yardstick, you will see how different will be your perception of people who live there.
Yeah.
Well, and also, you know, to summarize the discussion of the book and to bridge the discussion of myself, I would just very briefly tell you that I think that I need to tell this up front. I was not unhappy there.
Yeah.
I was quite successful there, and I don't want to make my story into my history, but certainly I do think that normalcy is something that was pretty much characteristic of the Soviet regime, and
yeah.
You could survive under it.
Yeah, sure. No, I
know just what you mean. I it's funny because when I lecture about the Soviet Union, I often stick in, and very prominently, the sentence that socialism worked pretty well for tens of millions of people, that they lived very happy, good lives there, and we shouldn't think otherwise.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean socialism and system is a wonderful thing, but it certainly worked for a lot of people, and, you know, that's important to say. Well, let me say this. We've taken up a lot of your time, Johanan, and I really appreciate it. It's been just as entertaining as I knew it would be. Let me ask you our traditional final question here on New Books in History. What are you working on now? What is your next project?
Now I'm delving into the material culture of the shtetl.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at the shtetl after the second partition of Poland, that is to say, when three provinces I'm interested in, Volhynia, Podol, and Kiev provinces, became under Russian control, or found themselves under Russian control, and I am trying to reconstruct the material culture of the shtetl, how this material culture shaped people's imagination and people's everyday behavior, and how people's everyday behavior shaped their material culture.
Mm-hmm. I can think of no one better to do the project, and I hope that you come on the show when you're done with it.
Thank you very much.
It was absolutely my pleasure. Well, Johanan Petrovsky-Sharon, we've been talking about Jews in the Russian Army, 1827 to 1917, drafted in modernity. Terrific book, and thank you very much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
Okay, bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Johanan Petrovsky-Sharon about his new book, Jews in the Russian Army, 1827 to 1917, drafted into modernity. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.